Hello, I'm Fully Batibo. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, unleashing a torrent of crude oil, President Joe Biden orders what he says is the unprecedented release of U.S. oil reserves. How will that affect markets, and will it help cut prices at the pumps? Also this week, what if Russian gas taps are turned off? Germany is one of the EU members most reliant on supplies and is particularly vulnerable. So can the Germans wean themselves off Russian gas? And India imposes a tax on the profits of cryptocurrency and aims to launch the digital rupee. Is that a move towards regulating virtual currency, and how will investors be affected? Thank you very much for joining us. Gasoline prices have risen sharply after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and Americans are feeling the pinch at the gas pump. With midterm elections just months away, President Joe Biden is under growing pressure to bring down the high energy prices. And he's attempting to do that by increasing supply. The president has ordered the release of at least 180 million barrels of oil from the U.S.'s strategic reserves over the next 6 months. That's the largest release of oil reserves since the country's stockpile was created more than 46 years ago.
This is a wartime bridge to increase oil supply until production ramps up later this year. And it is by far the largest release of our national reserve in our history. It will provide a historic amount of supply for a historic amount of time, a six-month bridge to the fall.
Well, the announcement marks the third time in 6 months the U.S. has tapped into its stockpiles. The president has also called for companies to pay fees if they choose not to use oil wells on land they lease from the government. And his promise to speed up the adoption of green energy sources, Biden plans to invoke the Defense Production Act to support the production of batteries like lithium and nickel, among others. Now, other members of the International Energy Agency, or IEA, a watchdog for Western consumer nations, also agreed to release more oil from their reserves. The move comes after the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, and its allies, including Russia, said they were sticking to their plan to gradually increase production. That's despite pressure from the U.S. and other nations to boost output more quickly. So, how does the strategic petroleum reserves work, and what does Biden's plan mean for the market? Let's have a look at the figures. The U.S. held 568 million barrels of oil as of March 25th, down from more than 700 million at their peak in 2009. But IEA member countries are required to keep equivalent to 90 days of net oil imports in emergency reserves. For the U.S., that's 315 million barrels, according to RBC Capital Markets. Once the latest release is complete, the nation will have just 70 million barrels in buffer. The release of 1 million barrels of oil a day over 6 months would make up almost 5% of American demand and 1% of global demand. That's why the IEA said last month as much as 3 million barrels a day of Russian oil production would be lost because of U.S. sanctions. Now, Biden's announcement has pushed oil prices to settle lower, but they were still twice the level a year ago. Brent crude, the global benchmark for oil prices, hit $139 a barrel last month after Russia's invasion of Ukraine began. The recent rise in crude prices has led to a jump in gasoline prices in the U.S., with the national average price of a gallon of gas at more than $4, up from almost $3 a year ago. Well, let's discuss all this further with Richard Bronze, cross-energy analyst at Energy Aspects. He joins us from London. Richard, very good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. So, will President Biden's release of U.S. oil reserves have much impact on prices beyond the very short term?
Well, I think there will be some impact, but it's probably going to mainly be reducing the risk that we see a really serious spike higher in prices this summer. I don't think the release on its own is going to push oil prices down much further from current levels.
So do you expect more disruptions ahead?
Yes, I think in terms of Russian supply, we're only beginning to see the actual disruption caused by sanctions and the self-sanctioning that we're seeing from a lot of European buyers. Russian refineries have had to cut production, and Russian exports are starting to fall, although they haven't fallen immediately after the start of the conflict. So these effects are still building up, and I think they're going to get worse over the next month or two.
I mean, it's a risky strategy, though, isn't it, for the US to draw down on its SPR so heavily? What if the war in Ukraine drags on?
Well, I think it's certainly true that you can't draw down at these kind of rates. And it's not just the US, it's advanced economies around the world that are announcing big releases. We're seeing them use their reserves to a degree that we've never seen in the past. And I think that reflects how serious the concerns about the state of energy markets are. But it also has to be a temporary measure. Now, Washington is hoping that by the time they finish this 6 months of release, US production will have increased substantially, and that will help to bridge the supply gap created by Russia.
Right.
I think that's quite optimistic. When we look at our forecasts for US shale production, we do see growth over this year, but not at the kind of pace that it seems the White House is hoping for.
Yeah.
So there's potentially a problem later in the summer or towards the end of the year when all of these releases have happened, and yet the market is still short of supply.
I was going to ask you precisely about that, Richard. I mean, is the amount being released from strategic petroleum reserves, whether the US or other countries, is it sufficient? What would it take to make up for the disruptions in Russian supplies and stabilize the market?
Well, we think Russian supply is going to fall by about 2 million barrels a day compared to the pre-conflict levels. And what you're looking at in the most optimistic scenario from these releases is under 1.5 million barrels a day. So it goes a long way to help bridge that gap, but it isn't sufficient on its own. You've also got to think about issues elsewhere. We're seeing less and less optimism that there'll be a nuclear deal with Iran
right.
that would lift sanctions on that country. And that was going to bring more supply onto the market. If that's not coming later in this year, again, you've got a gap that isn't going to be completely filled by these reserves.
Releasing these reserves, Richard, how does it exactly work? How is it structured? Is it going to be an exchange or outright sales? And what about logistical challenges and bottlenecks to move the oil from reserves to other places?
So this is going to be an outright sale. It's going to be made available to the market, and refineries or even international buyers can purchase it as long as they can have the logistical arrangements to receive that oil. The US government has said that it will repurchase this oil and refill the SPR later,
mm-hmm.
but that's going to be for the government to do, not for the buyers. So that's why it's not an exchange.
Okay.
But it does mean if prices are lower in the future, so anywhere under about $100 a barrel for WTI, the US government is going to be a big buyer of oil to put it back into the SPR.
Right.
Now, the logistical problems that you mentioned are very significant because although the caverns and the storage sites themselves can technically release oil very rapidly, that oil has to move through the US pipeline network, through the same pipes as commercial production. And the problem is, there are restrictions or limits on how much SPR you can release and move around that system without disrupting
right.
and impacting the commercial movements. And so we think that the actual rate of SPR release is going to be much lower than the 1 million barrels a day that's been announced, probably closer to 600,000 barrels a day.
Do you think, Richard, this will change the calculus for OPEC Plus, which has been resisting calls to increase output? Do you think it'll push them to try and increase the scale of their production?
If anything, I think this does the opposite.
Mm.
They can point to the fact that the US and others are releasing all this SPR and therefore say that the market doesn't need OPEC Plus to add more supply. They've been very, very reluctant over a couple of meetings since the conflict started to do anything to adjust their current plans. And I think for now that remains the case.
Now, we've heard renewed calls this week, Richard, for the EU to impose sanctions on Russia's energy sector after the alleged atrocities in Bucha came to light. But European countries, we know, have been reluctant, right, to impose a ban on Russian energy. Is a boycott of Russian oil and gas at all possible for Europe? What impact will it have on European economies like Germany, for example?
Well, I think even a few weeks ago, we'd have said it looked almost impossible. That calculus is changing. It appears the European Union will ban coal imports or at least put some kind of restrictions on them later this week. And that breaks the taboo when it comes to sanctioning energy flows. It doesn't mean we'll definitely get measures against oil and gas, but the longer the conflict in Ukraine goes on, the more likely they become. I think there are proposals already being developed for how the Europeans might cut off Russian oil imports. Gas is the hardest one in terms of the level that Europe depends on Russian imports and also the availability of alternative sources to fill that out. But we seem to be getting closer. The political pressure is building. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're weeks or months or more fighting in Ukraine, it becomes more and more likely that we do get some kind of ban. Now, you asked how can Europe respond or how can Europe deal with that? Technically, it's going to be possible, but it is going to be very expensive and it's going to be very disruptive. And so we are starting to see markets trying to price in what that would look like and how disruptive it might be. Certainly, you're going to get to the point where demand is going to have to be limited or rationed in certain sectors of the European economy to manage the loss of Russian oil and gas supplies if that happens.
Richard Braun, thank you very much for talking to us on Counting the Costs. Thank you for your time. European nations are on high alert for any disruption to Russian gas imports. President Vladimir Putin wants what he calls unfriendly buyers to pay in rubles or face supplies being cut off. Many European leaders have rejected the ultimatum and announced emergency plans to secure supplies. They include Germany, which is acting to cut its dependence on Russian energy by the middle of 2024. Dominic Kane reports from Berlin.
The Amur gas installation is far removed from the fighting in Ukraine. Here, the focus is on getting the product out of the ground and on its way to customers. 55% of German gas imports last year came from Russia, and 40% in the first quarter of this. But outrage at the war in Ukraine has changed many Europeans' thinking.
We are diversifying our sources and will do so in the coming months. We will use the existing LNG terminals on the West European coast and will build our own LNG terminals much faster than before.
Building new LNG or liquid natural gas terminals cannot cover all of Germany's energy needs. It's thought the terminals will not be on stream for several years, and in the meantime, gas will still be needed.
This is the Heizkraftwerk in central Berlin. Here, natural gas is turned into heat and light for thousands of homes, for industry and the public sector in this city. It's one of many such installations all across the country. Much of the power used in these stations comes from Russian natural gas and costs this country every year billions of dollars.
For many years, the political elite here tolerated such a dependence on Russian fossil fuels. Long after Crimea was annexed in 2014, Germany's previous Chancellor, Angela Merkel, did not stop the now shelved Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which connects Russia to Germany via the Baltic Sea.
Germany wants to secure its energy supply from various sources. Russian gas is part of this, but we do not rely only on Russian gas.
And yet, when she made those comments, Germany had already become increasingly reliant on Russian gas. She had even been warned publicly about its risks by the then US president.
But Germany is totally controlled by Russia, because they will be getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO, and I don't think it should have happened.
But many of the elite in Germany appeared not to be listening. I asked one leading petrochemical policy analyst why.
The idea was essentially to work through trade in order to lower the incentives for conflict. Because the moment you enhance trade, in theory, both sides engage, invest, have skin in the game, and that means you lower the political incentives for war or other types of conflict. That was the principal idea driving a lot of the Russia politics and policies of the German government, but also of other European governments. It didn't work, as we know, and yes, with hindsight, they should have known better.
Now, those governments are leading a dash from gas. The European Commission recently unveiled plans to cut many billions of cubic metres, or BCMs.
By the end of this year, we can replace 100 BCM of gas imports from Russia That is two-thirds of what we import from them. This will end our overdependency and give us much-needed room to manoeuvre.
Part of the EU plan mirrors proposals put forward by ministers in Berlin, marrying expediency over hydrocarbons now with their longer-term environmental ambitions.
And we see European governments across the board ramping up programs for renewables. 200 billion from the German government going into clean tech going forward. A whole program in the shape of Repower Europe at the European level.
What we don't know is how such a move will be perceived in the Kremlin. But with his recent requirement to make EU states pay for gas in rubles rather than dollars or euros, President Putin has already signaled his intent.
If these payments are not being accomplished, we would consider it as buyers' failure to meet their commitments with all the relevant consequences. Nobody sells anything to us for free, neither are we going to do charity work. That means the current contracts would be brought to a halt.
And that is a real worry for many across Europe, who wonder what might happen in winter if Russia switches off the gas. Several industrialists say such a denial of energy could be catastrophic to the economy. Dominic Kane, for Counting the Cost, Berlin.
Now, India has long been concerned by cryptocurrencies and was planning to ban them. But instead of prohibition, the Indian government appears to be moving towards legalizing and regulating the digital currency. And it's announced a 30% tax on gains from the transfer of digital assets such as bitcoins and non-fungible tokens. Here's our India correspondent, Elizabeth Puranam, in New Delhi.
Neil Kukreti has made tens of thousands of dollars investing and trading in cryptocurrency over the past 4 years. But the 24-year-old is selling at least half of all his digital assets before new taxes on them come into effect. From April, investors will have to pay 30% tax on sales of cryptocurrencies and won't be able to offset any losses from one against profits from another.
So that's how I will be managing, reducing my crypto exposure, getting more into stocks and forex, reducing the volume of trades that I am doing daily. And probably we will be seeing that in crypto exchanges in India, we will be seeing a decrease in volume because the thought process is pretty same.
Introduction of a central bank.
The government says a major increase in cryptocurrency transactions has made it essential to impose taxes.
There are around 25 million Indians who own cryptocurrency, with up to $10 billion worth of assets being traded every month. The average investor is just 24 years old, and most have a portfolio size of $650 to $1,300.
The founder of India's largest trading exchange says it doesn't make sense to impose the highest tax bracket, regardless of earnings.
So in India, you know, there are tax slabs where a certain amount that you earn in a year is not taxable at all. You don't have to pay income tax. But if you are dealing in crypto and you make a profit, irrespective of your tax bracket, you still have to pay the entire 30%, which is the highest tax slab in the country. And that's something of a dampener for a lot of people.
We need to plan properly.
Raghav Gupta began investing in cryptocurrency when he was at university in 2016. The 23-year-old's day job is running his family's carpet business, but all of his earnings are invested in cryptocurrencies. He's not happy about the high taxes, but relieved the government isn't banning cryptocurrency after it indicated last year that it would.
I think they're an important first step. Am I happy about them? No, I'm obviously not like happy with some of the particular things. But I think we should like recall back in December, everyone was dead sure that this is going, right? They're going to force liquidation from all exchanges and they're just going to ban it. And that didn't happen.
Many others agree with Raghav and say the taxes are too high and could push investors and businesses into moving their assets to countries with more favorable tax laws. But they also agree they're better than an outright ban. Elizabeth Puranam, Al Jazeera, New Delhi.
Now, along with the capital gains charge, the government announced a 1% tax deductible at source, or TDS. That will apply on all digital assets transfers above a certain size, starting on July 1st. India will also roll out its own blockchain-based currency, a digital rupee controlled by the Indian Central Bank, before April next year. Joining us now from New York is Roger Brown, Global Head of Tax Strategy at Chainalysis. Thank you for being with us on Counting the Costs, Roger. There's a big outcry in India right now after the government announced this 30% tax on virtual assets. I want to know first how significant it is. How much tax is imposed on cryptocurrency in different countries worldwide?
Every country tends to tax crypto slightly differently. You see common themes. The minority of countries, it's really only a handful, impose no capital gains tax at all. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they don't have a capital gains tax. In other instances, they'll only tax certain kinds of transactions. In general, for example, Austria and France don't tax crypto for crypto trades. When I sell XRP in exchange for Ethereum, they won't tax that. They'll wait till someone receives traditional fiat currency, which is just a term referring to cash. Mm-hmm. So 30% of the net gain, or if you buy an asset for 100, you sell it for 7 or 80, I have 20 of gain. So applying 30% to tax is similar to what many countries do. Mm-hmm. I would say that what is more than what some countries do is many countries will give you a reduction where if you lose money on a sale, there will be a deduction, a capital loss that you can use against similar types of gains. Okay. In the Indian proposal, you're not allowed to do that. So I think that is a departure from some other countries. Mm-hmm. In the way they also approach. And then I would say the 1% tax deduction at source is also a departure from what you see in other countries. So that in effect, but it is creditable against the 30% of gain.
Okay.
But that is a different increase.
So the 1% tax deductible at the source is a departure, you say. When you look at India and compare it to other countries, how big is India's cryptocurrency ecosystem, and how much can the government hope to collect from this crypto tax?
Well, the Indian ecosystem is quite large. It's obviously a very educated population. Mm-hmm. Many people pursue tech, and many people, crypto and blockchain necessarily are technologies. Among the crypto index in the region, Vietnam and India really rank at the top. Mm-hmm. So India is a major jurisdiction for crypto. It'll have a material impact. And we're seeing press reports now that some exchanges are seeing 30 to 70% drops in volume. I would say that unlike other asset classes, the market for trading crypto is global. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has a choice between jurisdiction A to trade and jurisdiction B, and the tax is different, then they'll go for that other jurisdiction.
Right. There is concern about 1%. Tax evasion, right? Will it be easy to track given the nature of the transactions?
So there are technologies that one can determine where trading occurs. The 30% tax, assuming that's a tax applied at the individual level, mm-hmm. And India will tax an Indian taxpayer, whether they're taxing at whether they're trading in WazirX or trading in Coinbase, say US or KuCoin, which is not Indian, if they tax them the same, the person may choose to trade on a foreign exchange, a non-Indian exchange. In terms of evasion, mm-hmm. India will have technologies available where if they can associate trading on a non-Indian exchange to a human being in India, mm-hmm. Then it is possible to determine whether it's tax evasion with technologies.
Right.
The OECD, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you briefly, Roger, how it would affect investors and liquidity.
It will affect liquidity. It could drive down prices. Crypto is global, so if somebody can get other prices in other jurisdictions, India is a major market, and it could have a depressing price on crypto in India. I would say that you could have non-Indian traders come in and see that the 1% is acceptable, and they'll come in and perhaps drive up the price. That's to be determined.
Thank you so much for talking to us about this, Roger. Roger Brown, joining us there from New York. Thank you for your insight.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at @FolibaAJE. And do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Costs. I'm Foliba Thibault from me and the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.